loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we take a look at the Syrian government, which is projecting a massive military assault on the northern city of Idlib in northern Syria, the last rebel stronghold, and the possibility that the United States government might militarily intervene once again in Syria in defense of those rebel factions, including al-Qaeda, in Idlib. And then today we continue our weekly series, False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with financial policy analyst Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, amid protests, the Senate Judiciary Committee today held hearings on the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to be a member of the Supreme Court. Democrats objected before the hearing even began because they have been denied access to documents they requested and have been fundraising on preventing Kavanaugh from being confirmed. But meanwhile, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer has agreed to expedited approval for 15 of President Trump's other judge nominees. Next, General John Nicholson, the outgoing commander of Allied forces in Afghanistan, gave a farewell speech in Kabul over the weekend as he prepared to return to the United States and retire. Unlike any of his predecessors, Nicholson called for an end to the war, an end to intercommunal violence, and an end to foreign intervention in the country. Then the New York Times revealed over the weekend that Oleg Deripaska, a prominent Russian billionaire, was repeatedly approached by the FBI between 2014 and 2016 and pressed to act as an informant. The FBI initially was looking for information on Russian organized crime. Later, they wanted information on Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort, but Deripaska declined each approach. Nonetheless, he has been drawn into the Russia collusion investigation, and he finds himself with powerful enemies in Congress. And then yesterday was Labor Day, the day set aside to honor the social and economic achievements of American workers. It's a national tribute to the contributions workers have made to the strength, prosperity, and well-being of the country. But organized labor is facing acute challenges thanks to recent court decisions. What do these decisions mean for the future of organized labor? And finally, Brazil's political crisis has entered a new stage with the country's top electoral court denying former President Lula, the most popular candidate in the country, a spot on the ballot for the country's upcoming presidential election. Meanwhile, outrage is sweeping the country in the aftermath of a fire that destroyed much of Brazil's most prominent museum, an apparent consequence of years of underfunding. And in other headlines, former Senator John Kyle was appointed by Arizona Governor Doug Ducey today to serve the remainder of John McCain's term. It's unclear if Kyle will serve until 2020 when McCain's seat is up for re-election, but he has committed to staying in office in his caretaker position until the end of this session of Congress. That's in January. Kyle's vote could be crucial for Republican efforts to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. Amazon became the second publicly traded company to be worth $1 trillion after Apple hit that mark on August 2nd. This year alone, founder Jeff Bezos has made $67 billion, or about $8 million an hour, making his total net worth $167 billion. His $67 billion gain in 2018 alone would make him the seventh richest man on Earth. Meanwhile, Amazon has long been accused of abuses, including keeping warehouse employees at a median pay of $28,446. A possible bombing attempt targeting the U.S. Embassy in Egypt took place today. Authorities arrested a man who they say was throwing an explosive device toward the embassy complex. It's unclear if the alleged attack was connected to any organization. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Syria. Russian military leaders said today that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad was ready to launch a military attack on the city of Idlib, with both the Russian and Syrians called a pocket of terrorism because of the foreign fighters that are based there. But as Assad gets ready to liberate this country in total and this city, we're also hearing comments by the President of the United States and his advisors that would suggest that the United States may be preparing to go to war once again in the Middle East to protect the city of Idlib from the Syrian government that demands sovereignty over this city. We're joined from San Francisco by Rick Sterling. He's an investigative journalist and member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. And we're joined by Ambassador Peter Ford. Ambassador Ford was the former UK ambassador to Syria. Rick Sterling, Ambassador Ford, welcome back.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Donald Trump tweeted, of course, President Bashar al-Assad of Syria must not recklessly attack Idlib province. The Russians and Iranians would be making a grave humanitarian mistake to take part in this potential human tragedy. Hundreds of thousands of people could be killed. Don't let that happen. And then Nikki Haley, U.S. ambassador to the U.N., all eyes are on the actions of Assad, Russia, and Iran in Idlib. Ambassador Ford, at least the rhetoric is being ratcheted up here in Washington and at the UN in New York.
Indeed it is, and it all sounds very ominous. However, call me guilty of wishful thinking here, but it is possible to read into Trump's remarks a little glimmer of light. It's not long ago that he was, last time he talked about Assad, it was that animal. Well, President Bashar al-Assad of Syria is how he's called in Trump's latest tweet, which at least shows a little bit of respect. And Trump goes on to call for avoidance of any reckless attack. Reckless attack. Does that mean an attack which is phased might be acceptable to the United States? A phased attack is actually what is planned. And I noticed that General Joseph Dunford, a bit later, earlier today, did call for a more targeted, phased attack rather than a full frontal assault. So there may be some subtle signaling going on here.
Rick Sterling, the Syrian government is determined to liberate Idlib and thus liberate the entire country of Syria from the control of terrorist organizations like al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate that's rebranded itself and that has a big influence in Idlib. The Syrian government has offered amnesty to at least Syrian fighters who have been fighting against it should they lay down their arms. But now we hear reports in Idlib that people who want to reconcile with the Syrian government, those fighters, they're being arrested or worse. Are we on a collision course, or might there be, I don't know if Ambassador Ford is suggesting exactly this, but tough rhetoric, but not necessarily a new military operation to prevent what the Syrian government is insisting must happen regarding Idlib?
Yeah, I agree with Ambassador Ford. I think there is some hope here. It's interesting how the Western media is playing this up, because Trump did not. Some of the media is using the red line reference again, and the headlines are saying Trump issued a tweet saying Syria must not attack Idlib. Trump did not say that. He said they must not recklessly attack.
That's right.
Idlib, and similarly, Joint Chiefs of Staff Dunford also made a somewhat, his statement was also quite moderate in the sense that he was recommending tailored operations and a phased approach, which is exactly the history of the Syrian military as they've recaptured East Aleppo, East Ghouta, Daraa. It's interesting how the media is in some way misleading the public in the way they're reporting on some of these statements. One thing that's important for listeners to know is that Idlib was taken by a huge onslaught that took place in the spring of 2015. It all came out of Turkey with heightened coordination between Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and it was led by the spearhead, according to Jabhat al-Nusra itself, the al-Qaeda branch, was a battalion from of Chinese Uyghurs. So the fact is that while there are Syrian terrorists in Nusra or Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, as they call themselves now, there are many foreign fighters. So the dilemma is what happens with the foreign fighters who cannot. Syria is offering reconciliation to Syrians. They're not offering reconciliation to foreign fighters. And the dilemma is what happens to these terrorists, which the West, after all, has promoted, trained, supplied military hardware to. What's going to happen to them? The West doesn't want them back, and it's trying to wash its hands of them, I suppose.
Ambassador Peter Ford, where would these foreign fighters go if they're all concentrated in Idlib, and there's supposed to be something like 10,000 of them that are concentrated there? Where do they go? The Turks would kill them if they tried to enter Turkey. The Russians and the Iranians and the Syrians are trying to kill them if they remain in Idlib. The Americans are chomping at the bit to jump in and bomb somebody. What would happen with these foreign fighters?
Well, the foreign fighters are pretty back to the wall. However, it's only a couple of days ago that Turkey was proposing to Hayat Tahrir al-Sham that they simply dissolve themselves constitutionally and regroup and become a Turkish militia. That option is still out there, just a rebadging is entirely possible. But they don't want it. It rather looks like the foreign fighters in particular don't trust anybody, and they would rather fight to the end, or as has happened with many ISIS, simply melt away and regroup in the desert somewhere, it's assuming they lose.
Just militarily, for either of you, but we'll start with Rick, can they melt away? Is there an escape route there? I mean, there's the north, that's Turkey. Anyway, can they, Rick?
I think it'll be difficult. Now, the border between Turkey and Syria is very difficult to control heavily, and that's how many of the militants have come into Syria. The difference now is that Turkey was happy to see them going from Turkey into Syria. It doesn't want them coming from Syria back into Turkey. So now there's struggle to the east at Manbij, where the U.S. And the Turks are both there. And then further to the east, of course, you've got the huge desert region, Raqqa and eastern Syria, which is more or less under the control of the U.S. The U.S. and France as well has many military bases there. So it's unclear what's going to happen. Idlib is the last densely or somewhat heavily populated area that's under terrorist control, but you've got all of eastern Syria that still is under occupation, foreign occupation in a sense.
I wanted to ask Ambassador Ford, too. I was in Greece a couple of weeks ago, and there was much talk about U.S. air assets moving out of Incirlik Air Force Base in southern Turkey, southwestern Turkey, because the Turks were reticent to allow the U.S. to initiate bombing raids from Incirlik, and that those American planes would be moving to Cyprus. Is there any truth to that? And in the event of hostilities, do you think the Americans would be allowed to use Incirlik?
Well, we only have to recall the Iraq conflict to remember how important those Turkish bases were. And given the state, the parlous state, or the turbulent state of Turkey's relations with the U.S., I think the U.S. are pretty wise not counting on using those Turkish bases. They could operate out of Dahran in Qatar, although it's quite far away. I guess they could use Cyprus, although I haven't seen actually reports of that myself. But the thing to watch here is a potential hoax chemical attack, because I really don't think the U.S. would attack on any other pretext. They wouldn't attack just because Assad and the Russians were trying to recover Idlib province using conventional weapons.
I want to just take a different, slightly different pose, and I'm coming from a position of having much less, actual knowledge as Ambassador Ford and Rick Sterling. It seems to me that when we look back at what happened with the, at least the rhetoric and the media attention here in the U.S. about the liberation of East Aleppo or East Ghouta, it was a rising crescendo of sort of histrionic headlines. Idlib would seem to me, if this battle is to be fought, would be a bigger battle. And if the Syrian government and the Russian Air Force is pounding rebel targets and liberating a part, even with a phased plan, it would seem to me that there would be this rising attack against Russia in particular, against Iran in particular, and of course against the Syrian government. But there will also be sort of a positioning of the media whereby people will say, his critics will say, Donald Trump isn't doing anything. He's not using American power, that he's weak in the face of Russian aggression. And if Trump were to carry out some sort of military operations now, right prior to the midterm elections, the voices who are his fiercest critics would in fact fall silent, because they would say, as they did before, when he sent 59 cruise missiles against Syria, he's acting presidential. And it would seem to me that there's a very good possibility that the U.S. will, in fact, under these circumstances, if this attack is taking place in the next 1 or 2 months, as it appears to be being prepared for, that there will be great pressure to carry out some sort of military operation. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think you're right, Brian. We're entering very dangerous territory here. The Russians have sent ships into the Mediterranean. They've sent a lot of battleships. They've got a lot of aircraft that they've stationed, which is a clear signal to the U.S. that they're not backing down, that they are going to stand by their belief in international law that Syria has a right to expel terrorists from its territory, and the U.S. does not have a right to attack Syria. And the last, the very first attack that took place in April of 2016, after that incident when Trump attacked Syria, there were all sorts of cheers, and the criticisms of him suddenly turned into cheers. He was suddenly seen as being quote-unquote presidential. 1 year later, in April of 2017, then it was a lot less satisfactory, or rather, I mean, April of 2018, the attacks that followed on the incident in Douma. And in that regard, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons issued a preliminary report indicating there was no evidence of sarin gas being found at Douma, which was the supposed pretext for the U.S. attacks. But the OPCW has dragged its heels in issuing its final report, and it's unclear what that means. So I think we're entering dangerous territory here, and it's really incumbent on all people who believe in international law to speak up very strongly and to resist and oppose these the warmongering cries, actually, coming from the media, the distortions of what Trump and Dunford are actually saying. Because if one looks at the past, the way the Syrians and Russians have approached the expulsion of terrorists has been very moderate, has been very restrained. They've opened humanitarian corridors. The bulk of the civilians have rushed into Syrian government area, and the histrionics about looming catastrophes have never been borne out in those actual cases. So it's incumbent on us to speak out and to stay the hand of the warmongers who are pressing, who seem to be pressing for a confrontation with Russia.
That was the voice of Rick Sterling. Rick joined us from the San Francisco Bay Area. Rick has got to run. Thank you, Rick Sterling, so much. We're going to continue our discussion with Ambassador Peter Ford. Ambassador Ford, anyway, your take on the same question and a response to both my question and to Rick's comments.
I don't disagree, but let's remember that we heard all this huffing and puffing not long ago over the South. You remember after Douma, the Assad forces moved to retake the South. And tens of thousands of civilians did flee I mean, it's not that long ago. It's only about three months ago. And we've been here before. We hear this hysteria. But at the end of the day, the U.S. did nothing. We heard bellicose noises before the retaking of the South. And in a way, the South was even more sensitive because of its proximity to Jordan and especially Israel. And those rebels in the South had enjoyed more U.S. support than any other groups anywhere in Syria. I think it more likely that the U.S. will hold its fire unless, and it's a very important unless, there is some pretext such as an alleged chemical weapons incident, which I do fully expect. I'll be surprised if there isn't another fake flag operation any time now, any day now.
Right. And that's what I expect, too, just based on, again, not having exact knowledge, and we're not a fly on anybody's wall, but just having sort of a general sense of things. And certainly John Bolton seemed to indicate or was essentially inviting a chemical weapons attack, because he said, just as John Kerry had, you know, tried to argue back in the summer of 2013, that Obama had said, don't cross our red line, which is the use of chemical weapons. Obama said it thinking, of course, Assad would never use chemical weapons because that would be the one thing that would invite U.S. intervention. And then Kerry was insistently arguing that, yes, in fact, Syria had used chemical weapons. And it was we were right at the precipice back then in early September 2013. A grassroots opposition, the decision by the British House of Commons that would have denied Obama a British ally to carry out a war that Obama himself seemed to be hesitant about, but all of his advisors wanted. We were almost there. And even though I don't actually think that was what was part of Trump's agenda, I just really wonder whether you have, with the likes of Pompeo and Bolton and Nikki Haley and others, and especially the so-called liberal media — liberal no longer has any meaning — the opposition to Trump, I think Trump will be pounded. I want to ask you, Peter, and again, this is a big picture question, because I want to always go back to the fundamentals here, which get lost in all the details and the weeds. If the Syrian government, which is depicted as a butcher government in Western media, if they had failed, if they had been overthrown, if they had been toppled, as the U.S. under Obama and Hillary Clinton and all the media were insisting that Assad must go, if they had been defeated, what would Syria look like?
I really don't want to imagine it. It would be so horrific. There really would have been a genocide. The Alawite community would have been the first to suffer. There would have been massacres of Christians. The exodus of refugees that we've seen would have been magnified five times over had the likes of the rebel, these same people who the U.S. is effectively defending in Idlib, if they had taken over, we would have seen massacres and a real genocide, and Syria would be like Afghanistan under the Taliban. It would have opened the gates to a Syrian Afghanistan. It's really ironic that the U.S. is still there in Afghanistan after God knows how many years trying to put down the aftermath of all that. And yet here in Syria, you've got a government, a secular government, that is trying to get rid of its Taliban, the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham here, and being deterred, or that is what the U.S. Policy amounts to, an attempt to defend the Syrian Taliban.
You know, this is really something that most Americans don't understand, and I would go on to say most American policymakers don't understand. When you look at the Assad government, whether it's today or pre-violence, this was a government that had Christian cabinet members, that had Christian assembly members, that had women in senior governmental positions, female ministers. This was a very progressive government in terms of being secular. That's something that the United States, I think, never understood as a policy.
Peter, maybe it's the U.S. appears to protest against the form of government if that government is sort of opposed to the U.S.
Yeah,
interests.
That's it right there.
But if the form of government is awful, is tyrannical, is Saudi-like,
that's right,
or whatever, but it's doing the bidding of America, then it's all cool. Maybe the form of government issue isn't actually a thing at all for Washington policymakers.
It's not. And why do feudal rulers, kings, emirs never get called dictators, which is what they are? Flagrantly. No, they get a pass because they kowtow. They're not mousy. They don't mouse off against the United States. That's what it comes down to.
I think that's it.
Yeah, and I have a final question. We have about 90 seconds left, Peter. Iran, Turkey, Russia functioned as the international guarantors of a Syrian peace process that was through the Kazakhstan talks, the Astana talks. They have an alliance of sorts and yet very different interests. Does Russia or can Russia be a constraint on Turkey at this moment? What do you think about that? We have about 1 minute left.
There's a very important summit coming up on Friday. Erdogan and Putin and the president of Iran focused essentially on Idlib. And it looks like they are going basically to agree on a strategy of bringing the Taliban, the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, and their allies to their knees, effectively liquidating them together. Turkey just a couple of days ago declared HTS a terrorist organization. So things are clearly moving in that direction. The HTS will be targeted in this phase of the Idlib campaign. And after that, it is hoped, I think all three parties hope, that there can be a reconciliation with the remaining rebels, so-called moderates, not actually that moderate, but they're similar to other opposition fighters who have reconciled, for example, in the south.
Yep. And the HTS, again, for our audience, is which the U.S. has been supporting, is really just the rebranded Al-Qaeda in Syria. Irony of ironies, the U.S. fights a 18-year long war against terror, so-called, and yet even though its targets seem to be Al-Qaeda, the U.S. is, in fact, with Al-Qaeda in Syria. Anyway, we're out of time. We were joined from London by Ambassador Peter Ford. Ambassador Ford was UK's ambassador to Syria. Earlier in the show, we were also joined by investigative journalist and member of the Syria Solidarity Movement, Rick Sterling. Stay with us. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series, it's every Tuesday, called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Daniel joins us from San Francisco. Daniel is a financial policy analyst in Northern California. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Again, happy Labor Day weekend to you. Everybody got a day off. But of course, there's actually no day off for the global economy. It keeps churning. That's 24/7, 365 days a year, of course. But I want to talk about some of the stories that I frankly were a little bit surprising to me. Maybe they shouldn't have been. One of them has to do with the surge, the reemergence of coal as king. That was the old cliche, coal as king. Let's talk about that story.
Yeah, definitely. So there was an article in the Wall Street Journal and a couple of other places where they talked about how coal production and coal purchasing has increased and returned to its 1998 levels. So in other words, roughly 50% of the power being produced in the world is produced using coal, which, as we know, is one of the dirtiest forms of energy production. Has all kinds of health, creates all kinds of health problems down the line. But it's being used at a growing rate, And mainly, there's a number of reasons why this is, but one of the most important reasons is certain emerging markets in Asia, such as China and Vietnam, are purchasing more coal as their economies really transform into kind of fully industrialized nations, which has happened, of course, a great deal in the last 20 years or so. So there was a decline in coal. There was some kind of modest reforms put into place to try to wean ourselves off of coal and to move it back, given, you know, the existential threat it creates in terms of global climate change. But it seems that that is kind of reversing course and that coal continues to be a major source of power in the global economy.
Let's talk a little bit more about why that would be. And then I want to switch the conversation to what's happening in the United States, because obviously Donald Trump is oriented in a very pro-coal direction.
And we've been backsliding as a country since Donald Trump's election. He has done exactly what he said he was going to do on these issues of energy and of coal.
Yeah. So this is obviously has political implications. It's part of Trump's electoral strategy. There's been the deregulation of Obama-era regulations that sort of made the use of coal less toxic in the United States. We want to come back to that, but let's stay with the issue of why emerging countries are using coal and how much they are using. Here's from the Wall Street Journal article that you alluded to. The rebound shows coal's resilience, especially in emerging regions, and recent events suggest the market for black combustible rock will remain strong. In the United States, the Trump administration has proposed to reverse U.S. rules on coal emissions, and countries including India and Vietnam are planning major coal projects. Coal accounted for 38% of the world's electric power generation in 2017, putting it at the same level as in 1998, that was 20 years ago, according to a report by BP PLC. A revival of the thermal coal market last year helped to lift mining companies' earnings and share prices. And then it goes over some of the different companies and how much money they're making. Daniel, the reality is we can't look at any energy source in the abstract. If you look at it in the abstract, you can say, without a doubt, coal is bad. Oil is bad. Bad for the environment. But here you have India, Vietnam, China, which is trying to reduce its reliance on coal, still uses a lot of coal. And in fact, these emerging economies, they're thinking about, well, how do we bring people out of poverty? How do we make sure that they have electricity in their village for the first time, say, in many areas? How do we have factories that are based on electricity? The economics of coal are such that people, countries, especially emerging countries, but now, of course, the United States, the most advanced industrial country, are making pragmatic decisions. Talk about the forces that drive coal production and coal usage.
Yeah, well, so the bottom line for why these other countries are using so much coal is because it's cheaper. So it's production cheaper, and also the building of coal-powered power plants is cheaper as well. The technology used to create them costs less than more renewable energies. And so these countries like India and Vietnam that want access to energy are going to go after the cheapest cost. But I think it's really important when we talk about coal being, quotes, the cheapest, what we kind of mean by that. Because on one hand, in a sense, yes, buying the parts and the materials to create coal-fired plants and to run them is cheaper than, say, you know, more renewable sources. That's not the cost, though. There's a tremendous social cost. And these social costs are not borne by the private entities that build these power plants, but they're borne by society at large. And so when I talk about social costs, I'm talking about increase in respiratory issues, health problems, carcinogens, and, of course, global climate change. You know, this threatens the continued existence of humanity, and that is a cost that all of us will bear, and not these individual coal power plants. So if, depending on how you define cost, it is cheaper, but in a broader sense, it's far, far more expensive and far, far more dangerous. The temptation would be to go after countries like, you know, Vietnam and India and wag the finger at them and say, you know, oh, look how, you know, dirty your energy production is. But the truth is, you know, if that was your motivation, the United States carbon footprint is far more massive than any other country in the world. And per capita, we have a much larger carbon footprint. I mean, really, if the rest of the world consumed like your average American consumed, we'd run out of resources in less than a year. I mean, we would just destroy ourselves extremely rapidly. These countries are going through this industrial revolution that we went through some time ago, where we used a ton of dirty energy, a ton of dirty coal, where the science of climate change wasn't really understood or widely popularized. And, you know, then we transitioned onto a more technologically advanced stage. That's the point that these countries are in. And it's not fair to turn and say to them and wag our fingers, oh, you're creating this dirty energy, you should use electric power plants, or solar power plants, when in fact, you know, we had no inclination of doing that as well. So it's really important to understand that the nature of this waste and this use of coal is really systemic, and it's based on the system of private property and private profits, and the drive for that private property and profits drives the use of this dirty energy.
Daniel, let me ask you a follow-up there. It's unclear to me, and I was hoping maybe you could enlighten me. It's unclear to me what happens to other forms of energy that are in use now when countries revert back to coal. So is the global economy growing enough that they're just building new coal-fired electric plants, or are they ceasing the use of things like natural gas or water power or whatever in order to go back to coal?
So they are not so much ceasing as they are realizing the need for increased energy production. So again, as their economies grow, the desire for more commodities are there. The desire to increase profit and grow the economy means a need for more energy. And when they're looking at their options and saying, how are we going to get more power? The coal power plants are more attractive because they are going to be cheaper. And so they could, in theory, build, you know, some solar power plants or wind power plants, but they're deciding to go with the coal market to save money. I also want to point out, it was mentioned earlier, you know, the Trump administration and the rollback of coal regulations. This is important and it matters, and it's something that should make us upset and get us active. That being said, let's not put too much just at the feet of Donald Trump, as if prior to his election, things were moving along in a, you know, renewable energy direction. They weren't. You know, in 2017, there was an uptick in carbon emissions from coal. Prior to that, for the last few years, it was pretty much flatline. That is to say, it wasn't going up, but it wasn't going down. So this is a much more systemic issue than just Donald Trump rolling back some regulations. So these different countries are struggling to power themselves, are struggling to get more energy and grow their economy, and coal makes an attractive, you know, option because, again, those social costs that I mentioned earlier aren't really factored into the costs that they're actually paying.
Daniel Sankey is our guest. Daniel Sankey is a financial policy analyst. We talk to Daniel every Tuesday on Loud and Clear in this segment called A Weekly Look at Wall Street and Corporate Capitalism with Daniel Sankey. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, if you're in the Washington, D.C. area, on two radio stations, 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. You can also subscribe to this show on iTunes or iHeartRadio or at Spotify or at Spreaker.com. And you can also listen to us every day live 4 to 6 p.m. at SputnikNews.com. And there the show is also archived. Daniel Sankey, I'm looking at an article. It comes from Financial Times, and it's from a year ago, about 9 months ago. And here's the headline: China hit by gas shortages as it moves away from coal. Subhead: small businesses and homes left in the cold as north of country targets pollution. And then there's a picture of like an industrial city in China, can't tell which one. It's very smog-filled, very polluted, chimneys or big smokestacks belching smoke. The first two paragraphs, very short, I want to read them to you, and because I think it's important. Again, we can't look at these issues in the abstract. The world absolutely must get rid of carbon emissions, right? And coal is chief amongst them. the best thing for the environment would never to bring another pound of coal out from the soil. The same with oil. But here's the opening of this article. Gas supply shortages are hitting North and Central China as Beijing tries to accelerate a shift away from coal rather than miss environmental targets this year. Now, these are targets that were also established in China and as part of the Paris Climate Treaty that President Trump removed the U.S. from immediately upon taking office. Then back to the article. The situation has left some residents, mainly urban migrants on neighborhoods ringing the cities, without heat as temperatures drop below zero. I mean, that's a reality that the Chinese government or any government in any country, but particularly in emerging countries, they have to contend with and cope with this, which shows in a way that if you want to eviscerate poverty, you want to allow working people who are working in factories not to live without heat in sub-zero temperatures, you have to do something. And that something is, in this case, because they couldn't afford to completely convert to renewable energy sources, to start bringing back more coal. And yet, as you're pointing out, this not only damages those cities where the people live, especially their kids and the older folks, it damages China, it damages the region. And guess what? All of this is in the atmosphere and damages the world. There needs to be a comprehensive approach. I mean, the nation state approach towards economic development itself under the circumstances where what each nation does impacts the entire world is actually a bit of an anachronism, I would say. There needs to be a global approach that takes into account economic development and environmental sustainability. You can't have one without the other.
Absolutely. When we talk about China and it shifting away and trying to make those different, you know, those difficult decisions about, you know, pushing back against global climate change and trying to find a solution and then simultaneously trying to keep its people warm, you know, you find yourself between a rock and a hard place. And that is largely due to the fact that China operates in a massive global capitalist system. And that is to say that its need to get those gas to power things as opposed to coal comes with a cost. And under a system where things are privatized and where there is the absolute need to make profit above all other things, it wasn't profitable enough for someone on the other end to sell that gas at the current price, and China couldn't afford it. So because some corporation or corporation somewhere needed to privately profit, China made the difficult decision to allow some people to go cold and then later to purchase coal, which damages the environment. I agree, there needs to be a global comprehensive move. And really, this could be a tremendously economically beneficial thing, even if we just look at the dollars and cents of it and forget that, you know, we'd be the human improvement to human life and sustainability would be incredible. But, you know, back in the 50s, there was this huge transition to automobiles. And it wasn't just the auto industry that produced so much wealth and so much jobs. It was also the need to build highways and roads and bridges and all these places to drive cars, which employed millions and millions of people and created a tremendous amount of economic growth. Well, the transition from a coal and oil-based economy to a renewable economy would require the same amount of building, the same amount of infrastructure, and the same amount of job creation here in the United States and elsewhere. You know, Trump talks about jobs and wanting to get people back to work. This would be a huge opportunity to get people back to work as we transitioned. We could take the trillions of dollars we spend right now dropping bombs on poor people in other countries and use it to make that transition. People's per capita income here would go up. Human life and the future of the planet would look a little brighter and a little more possible. So the problem with that is, though, currently coal companies, oil companies, and others, and their right to profit is coming before all of that and becoming before humans' rights to a job, humans' rights to a healthy, sustainable future. Because if we made that transition, of course, oil and coal companies would go bankrupt. They would go the way of the dodo. They'd move on, and they would be replaced by still others. And there are some very wealthy, powerful people, and a very small number of them, that want to do everything they can to prevent that from happening so they can continue to private profit, profit privately off of this particularly dangerous energy production system.
Daniel, let me ask you also, there are two different kinds of coal here in the United States. There's bituminous coal and anthracite. Anthracite burns cleaner than bituminous coal, and bituminous is kind of the famous one, the one that leaves soot and dust all over the place and that people breathe in and get cancer and black lung. I remember when I was a kid, my grandmother, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, and, you know, if your dad didn't work at the steel mill, he worked at the strip mine. And so I remember my grandmother having to sweep the porch twice a day. She did it in the morning and she did it in the evening to sweep all of the coal dust off the porch. So we know that bituminous coal is filthy when it burns. Anthracite is cleaner. Why do we burn so much bituminous coal in this country?
I mean, I think it's about cost. It's easier to obtain, it's cheaper to process, and there is more of an opportunity to profit off of it. The other one costs more, just like, you know, converting a power plant to a solar powered plant versus a coal powered plant is expensive. There's a cost to it, and cheaper, dirtier fuels are more profitable because these power companies are producing the same energy on the end, and they can make more if their inputs, i.e. coal versus solar, are cheaper. So that's a huge appeal to it. You know, and the communities that get impacted by them are typically poorer, more rural communities, communities with less of a voice, that if they constantly have to sweep their porches and essentially sweep carcinogens off their porches, there is going to be less of a public outcry. They're more isolated. They don't have the kind of dollars to matter. And so they're just going to kind of have to suffer through it. My great-grandfather immigrated here from Austria-Hungary and, you know, died mining coal. And, you know, his widow, my great-grandmother, was given $100 as a, you know, oops, sorry about that. And that was it. That's how it went for a coal mining family. And so, you know, perhaps not as brutal now, but certainly very brutal and very exploitative as anyone who works in coal country has experienced. It is still an extremely hazardous, you know, way to make a living, and really the kind of poorest of the poor do it because that's the only options they have. So, you know, as I was saying earlier, converting to different energy sources, these people working these coal mines would have new jobs, would have a way to provide for their families. They wouldn't need to worry about losing everything if the coal power plant goes belly up. And so we really have to ask ourselves, what is the social cost of how we're producing energy? Do we want to threaten the continuation of the human race, especially because there is a clear solution before us? There is a way to solve this problem. It's not, you know, some kind of impossibly complex scientific issue. We have the technology to do it. We have the means to do it. And it's a matter of actually being able to do it.
Let's switch to natural gas. You forwarded to us a fascinating article from the Wall Street Journal entitled, "In America's Hottest Drilling Spot, Gas is Going Up in Smoke." It's about flaring natural gas. But this natural gas is being flared, that is lit on fire at the top of the derrick just to dissipate it. Why isn't it being captured and used as fuel?
Yeah, so this is important. So this natural gas is a byproduct of drilling for oil, right? And shale drillers in Texas and New Mexico acquire this gas while they're drilling for oil. And actually, they acquire a tremendous amount of it. I believe the article I was reading said it could power Montana or New Hampshire to meet their daily needs. So, you know, these relatively large, you know, not compared to other states, but still a lot of people there could power them, just the byproducts. However, it's not profitable to ship it because the pipelines that would move it around have not been built, and there's not of enough impetus to actually build those pipelines yet. There's projects in the works. There may come out next year. Will they be able to ship it? But not yet. And so they have this energy resource that they could use to power other places. And instead of using it to power those places, they're lighting it on fire, which creates greenhouse gas emissions. I think it said something like 2 million cars worth of greenhouse gas emissions is what the article said.
That's disgusting.
It's incredible.
It's disgusting. It's incredible. So instead of using this to power people's, I don't know, TVs or blenders or whatever you have you, we're lighting it on fire. And the reason for that is really very clear, because if they were to just give out these gas to people who need the energy or industries who need the energy without charging them the requisite price, which they're not able to do due to the lack of pipeline, the energy industry for them would crash. It would depress because they'd be giving away stuff for free. They wouldn't be profiting, and there wouldn't be any impetus to buy their oil. You could just use the free gas that they're pumping out. And I think that's a really important point that you need to pay attention, that they're not producing natural gas and oil for purposes of creating power. They're doing it for purposes of creating profit. They're not meeting a human need. They're making money off of it. And because they can't make money off of the gas, it's actually not useful to them. So they just light it on fire. It's not to be sold because it can't be sold at this point. Under this current economic system, especially in the energy sector, there's a tremendous amount of waste. And this is one example of that waste, where it's not just wasting this energy uselessly. It's wasting it in such a way that it actually harms human life by increasing, you know, CO2 emissions. So it's really kind of a stark example of how under this system of private property and socialized cost, this sort of insanity has its own kind of internal logic to the detriment of millions of people.
Daniel, let's move on to another issue. Another fascinating one, really. This is about Sherwin-Williams, the very well-known, enormous paint company. It's being sued for hundreds of millions of dollars. Actually, it's already been ordered to pay the hundreds of millions of dollars. It's not just being sued. It's lost. Because of paint that it sold and advertisements for the paint dating back to 1904. Now, that paint had lead in it. And, of course, lead has poisoned probably millions of people over the last century plus. And only now the chickens are coming home to roost. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is important. Sherwin-Williams, since 1904, has been selling and promoting and advertising for different lead-based paints. And it came out, I believe, in 1954, a study more publicly that said, hey, lead-based paints are bad. You know, they can make you very sick and they can hurt you. There's evidence, and this is what the plaintiffs are alleging, that Sherwin-Williams was aware of this way before 1954 and just said, oh, well, that's the cost of doing business. Let's keep advertising. A little bit like Big Tobacco, where they became aware that this stuff causes cancer, but they were still going to keep promoting it. So Sherwin-Williams right now is fighting not so much to say, well, we don't want to pay any money, but they want to pay less money because they're trying to argue that, well, they didn't know, it wasn't common knowledge that this stuff was poisonous until after 1950. But that begs the question that from 1950 on, when it became common knowledge, they continued to promote this stuff and they continued to sell it, that this, you know, lead-based paint that continues to poison people. And so this is, you know, another example of that private profit and social cost, because, of course, they profited tremendously. Sherwin-Williams paint is a very well-known brand name and has done very well for itself since 1904. But who has borne the cost? Well, who's borne the cost are the people who used it, their consumers, and the people who lived in homes where it's in. And the truth is, there are many places, I'm sure, throughout the United States that still are painted with that lead-based paint, that still have it, you know, in the walls and part of its infrastructure, because, you know, the residents there can't afford to strip it out in a safe way and repaint it because, of course, that's expensive and they, you know, don't have the money to do it. And many residents might not even be aware that that is an issue or that that is in their particular residence. I mean, in Fruitvale, which is near where I live, there's a huge issue with lead-based paint in all these old buildings that landlords and slumlords refuse to fix up, and they paint with lead-based paint, and all these poor families, immigrant families who really don't have an opportunity to fight back much are, you know, being poisoned by this stuff, and they don't have a whole lot of legal recourse. And Sherwin-Williams kind of fits into that ecosystem, as I'm sure many of those houses were painted with that lead-based paint. So I think it's really kind of gross when you look at the argument that they're trying to make, that they don't want to pay the $730 million. They want it to drop down to $409 million to say, well, okay, sure, we lied to everyone and poisoned them. But that was only after 1950. So that's apparently only $409 million worth of evil versus, you know, 700 and so many million dollars of evil. And, you know, this is a calculated risk that the company took. And really, if you think about it, even if they are forced to pay the $709 million, they still profited hugely. I mean, they still made billions of dollars off of this. So really, it kind of makes sense for them to do it. There's no real incentive for them to roll this back or to take a closer look at it because they're not really losing their profits for it. They still made a lot of profits and they just had to pay this little fee, you could say, so that they could continue on. I think it's also important to point out, nobody's going to jail, right? No CEOs, no advertisers. The people who control the company, who determine of its direction, who decided, yes, let's poison people for money, let's risk their lives. Nobody's going to be facing prison. So they just pay a big fat fine and then move on. And that there's no reason to think that the Sherwin Williams and other companies like that of the world won't continue to behave that way so long as the consequences for their actions are relatively minuscule.
That's the voice of Daniel Sankey. Daniel joins us every Tuesday here at Loud and Clear on False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. 2 minutes left. A tech support scam prompts Google to act. What's that story?
One of the things I want to point out is there's these very common tech support scams that people should be aware of, where people pose as employees of Apple or Microsoft and gain access to your computer by you providing them information about your computer and then infect it with viruses and such. What made it interesting is that Google promoted ads for these companies, they claim unwillingly, is so that these fake companies looked more legitimate using Google's advertising. Google, of course, profited off of this advertising, promoting these scammers. And now it's become such a huge issue and it's become mainstream news that Google is now being forced to crack down and make sure it's not, you know, selling advertisements to companies that are attempting to commit cybercrime, basically. I think really the important part of the story is to realize that Google was making money off of people engaged in cybercrime. Look, Google is a very smart company. They know exactly what I'm interested in. They know my profiles. They know me down to my very last, you know, detail based on all the data they collect on me. And yet somehow they weren't able to figure out that all these people were committing crimes and scams on other people using its browser. And infecting their computers with viruses. I think that Google has controls in place that it chose to make somewhat lax so that it was very easy to get through the barrier of paying for advertising so that criminal elements like this could pay for advertising and Google, in part, you know, profited off of it. So I think it's a really important point in this story to pay attention to that, yes, of course, the scammers were bad and taking advantage of people, but they couldn't have done it without Google. And Google helped them tremendously so that they could gain access to people's computers and identities and take advantage of them.
In fact, it's actually another sort of version of the Google business model.
Yeah, exactly. Is that sort of pay for play. And, you know, we're seeing this with Facebook. We're seeing this with other data collection companies where there's a real crackdown on them as people are becoming more and more aware of how they abuse that data and how they abuse that power for profit.
We'll leave it right there. We were joined by Daniel Sankey, financial policy analyst. Daniel joins us every Tuesday on this segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. You can also listen to this particular interview at Spreaker.com. You go to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker interviews, not just Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, the show, but interviews. You can listen to the individual segment. You can also subscribe to it at iTunes, at iHeartRadio, and also at Spotify. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.